This is the Mindful Musical Life Podcast. I'm Kevin Miske. This week, I'm talking with Dr. Kayla Bellamy. Kayla serves as the assistant professor of bassoon at Colorado State University, where she teaches graduate and undergraduate bassoon students, coaches chamber music, and conducts the contemporary music ensembles. Kayla is in demand nationally as a soloist and orchestral bassoonist, and keeps a full schedule of guest teaching and conducting as well. In our conversation, we discuss Kayla's experiences with mindfulness in her training as a triathlete, and her preferred practices in the moments before performance or in her short breaks during her busy schedule. If you find it challenging to sit in formal meditation, Kayla's ideas about mindfulness will be especially helpful for you. I hope you enjoyed this wonderful conversation with Dr. Kayla Bellamy. So Kayla, thank you so much for joining us today. I usually like to start off with a question about kind of what your mindfulness or meditation or contemplative practice kind of looks like and where you got started with that, what made you interested in it, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks so much for having me to talk today. My mindfulness, kind of my journey to mindfulness and meditation, I suppose, has been somewhat circuitous. It actually was initially recommended to me from a counseling standpoint, from a therapist. That was when I was in graduate school, and I was, as most of us do at some point over the course of either undergraduate or graduate or even high school study, right? We have some rough times, and attending a group mindfulness session was something that was recommended to me, and it really just didn't click with me. I wasn't getting kind of what was intended, I felt like, out of that particular practice. I later came to put together that I'm quite an empathic human, and I had not yet really figured out how to approach a vulnerable state, as sometimes happens with meditation and mindfulness, without the ability to, you know, protect myself from whatever everyone else was bringing to the room. So I was pretty turned off for several years, from kind of late undergraduate, early master's, until I guess about 3 years ago, I started my own kind of personal practice that really came from a place that was very closely related to my athletic training. So I was doing endurance running and cycling, and that was when I was really kind of more heavily into training for amateur triathlons. And I found that I was reaching that flow state through athletic activities, and it was really benefiting me in terms of just my mental outlook on prioritizing things like what I had gone into the session with the intent of doing, right? If it was a running session, I was able to really focus on the success of that particular initiative rather than kind of spiraling into issues that we run into with self-worth and my mind wandering and not able to focus and achieve the things that I wanted to. And so I actually used that as sort of the back door into my mindfulness practice, which today is split into many pieces. I have some sort of typical body scans that I'll do before my musical practice sessions and before performances and things like that that are much more target focused. But then I also have, you know, a more personal sort of spiritually driven like journaling sessions that I'll do pretty much on a daily basis. Usually that's right when I wake up. I set the coffee and walk the dogs and then sit down for my more kind of personal emotion driven meditations.
Yeah, that's great. It's interesting. I think it's really important for people to know that that other people have the kind of experience that you just described with their first foyer into meditation or mindfulness, that like this didn't quite work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I applaud you for coming back to it and like looking for a way to help it to resonate with you specifically and make it a way that's more authentically you.
Yeah, I think everybody has a way to enter that kind of headspace or that heart space or whatever you want to call it, depending on how you're comfortable framing that sense of, you know, peace and stillness. I think we all use slightly different words for that depending on what our field of study is or how we've been, you know, socialized to accept or reject that concept of mindfulness. But for me, it was much more, like I said, much more of a practice that was based on, that came from this, a different skill, but came from adjacent skill that I found I was having these types of experiences that I knew I was supposed to have. That's with me with giant air quotes, right? That I was supposed to have by meditating that just didn't happen when I meditated. It was much more of a stressful experience because it was so goal oriented and came and approached from, you know, as a structural therapeutic approach. And there was, you know, there was a purpose for doing it, and there was a way that I was, again, air quotes, supposed to measure success or failure of meditation, which is certainly not, you know, not the way that that practice is most helpful.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's so important for everyone to, maybe if someone's listening and they're kind of just getting into meditation or thinking about it, one of the key things that I stress so much as often as possible is the non-judgmental environment, and then just allowing whatever comes up to be, right? And that, but the first part, the non-judgmental environment, I think is the most important thing, where you can have a goal in mind, like, you know, focusing on the breath, let's say, or on a, like a body scan, focusing on bodily sensations as you're tracking through the body. But when you get distracted, and I always use the word when, not if, because I always get, every single time I do any kind of meditative anything, I always get distracted at some point. But knowing that that's part of the process, and like allowing that to be there, and then just redirecting with a kindness and a patience with yourself, rather than what most musicians are used to, which is that like immediate reaction to try to fix it, or like, oh, I failed, right, I have to do something better.
I do think sometimes when we say, I completely agree, you know, for one, with everything you're saying, and I remember hearing that early on in sort of my learning process. And that's not to say that learning process is over, certainly, but when I was really trying to do it, you know, when I was trying so hard to meditate, which I'm laughing at that now, because the idea of really trying to meditate is pretty counterproductive. Even the idea of sitting still and approaching the thoughts that came and went with kindness was, to, for me, still layered with this idea of you can be kind, but you're still failing. You know, there was like that layer of, if I'm really good at this, then it's still not going to happen. If I'm approaching it with kindness, it's just being nice to myself until I'm able to do it right. Which I don't think is actually an uncommon sort of resistance, especially with musicians, where we are told in lessons, say if you have a kind teacher, if we're fortunate enough to have a very kind teacher, then they're forgiving of the learning process, but there's still this sort of underscoring of, but once you're good at it, it won't happen. And I think for me, with the meditation process, learning to, or accepting that I could reframe the idea of thoughts that come and go when I'm trying to be still, or if I go into a practice intending to be still and I'm just not able to get there, and there are thoughts that come in, not that I need to be kind with them because we all fail, but that I need to be kind with them because there's something in my mind or my heart or the universe, or however you want to think of it, there's something that I need more than stillness. That if that thought won't leave me alone, then it's telling me something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think listening, being able to listen to yourself. There's all sorts of layers of philosophy that we could, you know, dive through, I'm sure. But like that concept of being in tune with yourself, being in tune with your body and your thoughts and your needs. And I think the ability to do that comes from that ability to have at least some kind of like mindful state, even if it's, you know, just like for a moment, for a second, for a breath, or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And I much more often than not file mindfulness, you know, for thinking, hopefully not in terms of success and failure, but if that's the framework we're presented, then the successful session is the one in which you're aware of what's happening and you're able to notice it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Not necessarily even placing the judgment on whether or not you're able to be non-judgmental. Right. But recognizing that those judgments don't come from you and don't come from kind of whatever stillness you're tapping into. They come from what people have told us about how we're supposed to be in the world. Yeah. And that an actual mindfulness practice is really only that. It's the ability to be self-aware. And if you're noticing things when you're aware, then all of those things are valuable. It's sort of like what we do with emotion, right? We may say that we're willing to accept all emotions as acceptable. They're all normal, but on some level, we secretly want to be more happy than sad. You know, we have this like unspoken hierarchy. And right. I think sometimes there's a little bit of a trap, especially early on in meditation or mindfulness journeys, regardless of age of whoever's kind of getting into it, that stillness is better than active. And I'm much more of the mindset or the philosophy that as long as you're aware, then, you know, an active meditation or observing your own thoughts and recognizing that they're there and not trying to make them go away is just as valuable as being able to let them go.
I absolutely agree. I'd love to kind of tie that into a comment that you made earlier on about how you found that state of flow and that state of awareness through like your some of like the workouts you were doing in preparation for triathlons.
Mm-hmm.
So can you describe kind of what that sensation was like, or what that felt like, or what, you know, you were experiencing in your inner mind, or however you wanted to talk about it?
Yeah, I think for me it was very closely tied to the rhythmic element, both, you know, running and cycling, and then swimming was sort of the third sport that I added on the way to triathlon. I had to teach myself how to swim on YouTube, so that was certainly not a calming, mindful experience for quite a while. But once you get proficient enough at those, then they become very predictable cyclical motions. And having that bilateral, you know, left leg, right leg, or left arm, right arm, and hopefully it's as symmetrical as your body will allow, that it becomes a balanced physical experience, and it's repetitive enough that is soothing. But if you're doing something like actively training, I found if I was running intervals or, you know, cycling a particular either set of intervals also, or doing a workout rather than just sort of going out for a run or out for a swim, then it really hit the center of that target of something that was repetitive enough and soothing that I could sense, you know, the literal flow of motion in my body, but also active enough that there was something that I was focused on every time. You know, when I was really actively learning swim form, you know, I was very closely paying attention to just the last two fingers on my hand, you know, just ring finger and pinky, and when exactly does that hit the water? And it became a very embodied mindfulness that translated first really well, actually, to my practicing. So I primarily, you know, as you know, play bassoon, and I found that translated really well to like long tones, that if I was doing repetitive articulation or scale patterns, even practicing double tonguing, things that were cyclical patterns, that I could target my focus to a particular body part, and it became a way of both existing in the stillness and also being hyper aware of one very small detail that accessed that same kind of flow. And then I was able to sort of approach this backwards, I think, from how a lot of people we recommend, you know, sit very still in a chair and then focus on your breathing and, you know, think about the air coming in through your throat and down your lungs. But for me, it was entirely backwards, going from a complicated activity like swimming or running to something that was a little more simple, like playing long tones on my instrument, playing bassoon long tones in the comfortable register, to now I think I can do this if I don't have so much to focus on.
Yeah, that's so great. It's really interesting what you said about that being able to like be hyper-focused on one specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. While you're doing long tones, let's say, like transferring your experience in the pool, let's say, to like in the practice room.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice, for me, if I do something like that, typically I'll notice like areas of tension or tightness that I presently or previously wasn't aware of start to kind of dissolve or to change or go away.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice anything like that with your playing where you would, you know, be hyper-focused on, let's say, just a sensation of your finger on a key or something, or
mm-hmm.
whatever it might be, and then other things would you be aware of as well that you weren't intending originally?
Yeah, I mean, this may or may not be kind of where you were headed. I didn't, I wasn't as aware in the moment of now I notice that my shoulder's lower or something like that. It wasn't as acute. I know that it was happening, but it, for me, I had that realization, I think, on a grander scheme when I went back. This was actually when I was applying for some collegiate positions. You know, they ask for recordings over the past few years. And I went back. It was when I applied for the position that I'm in now. And I had to go through and, you know, update the portfolio page of my website and repick the tracks that I was going to use for, you know, listening through all my recitals over the last year or so. And I just happened to pull up the page of my website that I'd used for my online portfolio from when I initially applied to my first position, for my first college position that I got, not my first college position ever, you know, because it was dozens of rejections before the first one, the first one that worked, right, that I ended up with a job offer, listening to those tracks and then listening to the ones that were, you know, 5 or 6 years newer, more recent, that were after I had really become a much more mindful human, specific to my playing, but also just in life. And the difference that I heard immediately from a musical perspective was resonance. There's no... It sounds like a different person.
Wow.
My entire tone is different. The dynamic range, the upper end of my dynamic range in particular. I can play really loud without that constriction, you know? And so I know that it comes from a very physical place, but I heard it first in resonance for sure.
Wow. That's so neat. That's so nice when you notice those kinds of changes over the long term. And you can actually like ascribe it to an element that you've changed that's very specific like that, like being more mindful and more aware of your, like while you're actually playing about specific things like that. That's so great.
I mean, it was comparable, Kevin, to when I bought a new bassoon.
Wow.
It was the same kind of level of change as when I went from my student model instrument to the professional model in graduate school. And I was playing on the same, you know, I scraped my reeds the same way, the same vocal, the same instrument. In a couple cases, even the same repertoire, you know, some standard pieces that you just come back to over the years. Mm-hmm. And it was a shocking difference.
Wow. That's so great. I'm so glad to hear that. You also mentioned a body scan that you do, I think you said right before you go out to perform or as part of like a morning, like before you start practicing, things like that. Can you describe a little bit what that looks like?
Yeah, mine's very simple. I know some people like to do sort of the scan top to bottom or bottom to top. I do from foot up to kind of forehead. And body scan for me is, it takes about, oh goodness, 15 seconds. It's relatively quick because I'm not trying to fix anything. I found that when I started doing body scans as part of, you know, like your quote unquote beginner meditative practice, that if I spent too long on it, then I very quickly got into a place of correction. I would notice tension or I would notice asymmetry and I would try to do something about it if I spent a long time, if I didn't go quickly enough. And so I really just spend a couple seconds on each. For me, it helps to go to have, I imagine them almost like dams, like water dams. That I have, I'm just focusing on my feet and there's a dam at my ankles and it only takes about a second and I just notice what's happening there and make a mental note. Like if I'm doing this right now, I have my legs crossed, which I'm avoiding my judgment statement, right, of how I should be sitting. That's just how I happen to be sitting. So I'm close enough to my microphone, but I notice there's a difference in, you know, left to right foot. That's interesting. I'm, you know, normally have my foot balanced on the tripod and I'm a little asymmetrical now. And then the dam opens and my focus flows up to my knees. Because of that extra tension in that left foot, which is the one planted on the ground, I noticed that my left calf is a little more clenched than my right calf. Okay, that's worth noticing. Boom. And then the dam opens up and I can go up to my hips. And I'm relatively balanced by in the way that I'm seated on the chair. I notice that there's equal weight from left to right if I'm thinking about kind of the top of my femur sits bones. Great. I'm balanced. Boom. Another dam opens and I can go up to kind of center chest. And this is taking longer than 15 seconds as I narrate it, but right, we all think faster than we speak. Right?
Yeah, that's great. so what do you find that does for you when you do that before playing?
Before playing, it does give me some action items. So I can notice from day to day after I've done it a couple days or a couple sessions, or even over the course of a day before I do my morning practice session, before I play, you know, in the faculty quintet rehearsal, if I do another quick one while we're sitting on stage, I can notice whether or not I have started holding things in my body. Oftentimes that's work or personal stress. If I have had a particularly stressful morning, I'll notice a little asymmetry. And for me, it's more just awareness, not so that I can make a physical change, but so that I can be, so that I can, if possible, kind of reframe future aspects of my day. I know that I'm a little tighter than I would like to be at this moment, so I'm going to accept that I may be a little quicker to be frustrated in this upcoming rehearsal. So, which may or may not be a little different than some, I haven't heard many of the people that you've spoken to, but I know a lot of people will use body scans specifically, you know, physical for physical. Mm-hmm. I kind of scan left or right side so I know where I can release my tension. And mine's a little more strictly for information. So it's less prescriptive and more descriptive, I would say, than average.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's great.
It also seems more just awareness and less, you know, in like less, like you said, less prescriptive. It's not, you're not trying mm-hmm. to achieve anything. You're not trying to accomplish anything. It's just, if my shoulder happens to be tight, it's tight. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to fix it.
Rather than if it's tight, it's my job to loosen it right now. Mm. Which I found for me, and I don't think it's uncommon for with the students that I work with, for example, we do some of these, I don't know how many, every time I do I just did a posture class and studio class this last week, we talked about, you know, balancing and the tripod and the pelvic bucket and all of the, you know, kind of getting centered. And as soon as you ask a room full of high achievers or high aspiration humans, which is all of us, you know, if you're listening to a podcast like this, you're one of those people. As soon as you say, okay, great, now let's just close our eyes and we're going to see what's happening in our body. Everybody tries to sit up what they feel like is straighter. We all try to fix it. We assume what the problem is and we try to fix it. And most of the time that actually adds tension rather than releases it.
And I bet a bunch of people who are listening also just straightened up.
So yes. As soon as I said body scan and notice your side to side, I wonder how many people shifted around in their chairs. Mm-hmm.
Right? No judgment if you did. We're not judging you.
Yeah. Not judging. It's worth noting. And if you have the mental capacity and the emotional capacity right now to dig in just a tiny bit as to why it's important to you to be good at that and why you define good the way you do.
Yeah, that's such a good question to drop in to ourselves now and then. Reminders as to why we're trying to do certain things the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think any practice like this at any level, whether it's, you know, like what you're describing or someone who's very strict about, you know, I meditate for an hour every day or whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
you know, the ability to be aware of what you're doing and then to be able to ask yourself why
mm-hmm.
and to look at those answers without judging yourself. I think that's such a valuable skill to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed when you're, you know, going back, especially having released one CD already and then working on another one,
mm-hmm.
Part of that process is listening to recordings of yourself over and over and over and over and over again and mm-hmm. picking sections and making decisions about what track to keep and things like that. What have you noticed any of this kind of work kind of creeping into that process as well?
Do you mean the actual review of tracks
process? Yeah, it can be kind of a danger spot for, I know, a lot of musicians who can't stand listening to themselves and they have a hard time with that.
Yeah, it's really helped. I found the editing and mixing process for this second CD to be a much more emotionally and mentally healthier process than it was the first time around, which when I was listening through, that CD was, we recorded it in 2017. It was released in 2018. And I remember very vividly going through the different takes of that and just being so critical. And I was throwing out takes based on error, if that makes sense. Mm. You know, I was listening, and as soon as I heard something wrong, it was not acceptable. And that's what caused something to be, you know, not put in the can. And when I was listening to this one, I found myself much more, sort of from the opposite mindset. I was flagging tracks that I felt like had the most interesting moments or the most interesting, the most resonant sound. I really gravitate towards sound, which is actually what I, when I talk about actually developing, scraping reeds and developing your own fundamentals, I think we have to be concerned with tone actually toward the end of the process, because you have to have response and intonation and all of these really technical things. Otherwise, you're just playing with a really pretty sound in a way that no one can blend with. But I do gravitate to listen to resonance and tone very frequently. And it was really freeing to be able to listen to these tracks of myself and just which ones are the most convincing and the ones that have the best sound. And then I found myself sort of bummed, you know, when I had to throw it out because there was a mistake. Because it was the least technically proficient of all the tracks that I had in front of me. I was like, oh, I actually really did play this one better. Mm. And so I need to go, you know, as I'm selecting tracks, making the priorities a little bit different, was really nice. It felt more in line with how I listen to music and how I consume art, you know, how I think of art as human expression. And that was much more, you know, thinking of myself more in line with how I think of others, which is, you know, far more kind. We're always more kind to other people than we are to ourselves.
I think that's a really important point, that you just mentioned. I just want to make sure that I understood it correctly, but that, like, let's say that we're listening to a recital or we're watching a YouTube video of something, right? Noticing what kind of tone we're, you know, listening and interpreting the music with, you know, like, what are you thinking when you're watching someone play either live or recorded or whatever it might be? And, you know, most people are just enjoying it, right? And like, wow, that sounded awesome, you know? I don't think many people are like waiting for mistakes and like hoping ill will. I hope not.
I tell this to every, you know, every student I can get a hold of every time that they're, I mean, you work at a college as well, and you know that we have the end of semester juries and performance exams, and you get graded on recitals, and we have all these, you know, quantitative grading mechanisms for successful performances, and juries are always the ones that come to mind for me, that students are just freaked out about it, right? I have to go sit in front of a room in front of all these people, and they're often very kind about it, right? These musicians that I respect and play for them, and I want to play well. And as many of them as I can get a hold of every semester, I have to remind them that when I'm sitting on that panel, the number one thing that I'm going to be sitting there for 8 hours, dude, like 8 hours, you know, the number one thing that I want is to see 8 hours of musicians doing their thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for 8 hours of mistake hunting, or, you know, that's not a productive process. That's not a joyful process. It's not a process that reflects why any of us are in music. And we put these requirements on ourselves, you know, go into a performance trying to avoid mistake, as opposed to going into a performance trying to promote, you know, expression and joy and share beauty and all of these wonderful things that are the reasons we're all in this field. But for some reason, we're often not willing to apply that lens to our own performance.
Yeah, I would venture an opinion that that's probably one of the most important lessons that you can constantly remind yourself of
as any level of musician. And I'm sure it's any level of anything in any field. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody, I certainly don't, heaven forbid, I go into surgery waiting for my doctor to make a mistake, you know?
Right. When have you taken personally any like big orchestral auditions, or I'm sure you've prepared orchestral excerpts before. So how do you explain to a student, let's say, like how to analyze your preparation for something like that that's so detail oriented and so specific, while still remained in that mindset of, you know, looking for beauty in music and looking for the quality rather than just the mistakes?
That's such a great question. For me, a lot of it comes actually from language reframing. So it's all the same, you know, we're aiming for the same product that you want, a, you know, a beautiful, perfectly in tune, nuanced opening to write a spring. You know, that's the ultimate goal. But in the process of striving for that, rather than framing this as I need to set up my embouchure in just this way so that I don't crack the high C. Instead of that, which is how most of us, right? It's don't do this. Don't play Marriage of Figaro too loud. You know, don't scoop into the D flat and bolero like all those trombone players. You know, ours is supposed to be crisp. You know, and we have all of these things that we list as, I had a teacher once that referred to them as process cues, and the being the thing that you need to think about. Right, it's a very robotic sort of mechanical way of breaking down just the techniques required for something. But if that cue is framed with the word no, whether it's don't do this or, you know, avoid that, anything that has a negative command, our brains actually are wired to process the verb first. And so if I'm getting ready to play the Mozart bassoon concerto exposition for the first thing on my orchestral audition, and the first thing that goes through my mind is, you know, don't crack the B flat, then the very first thing my brain hears is crack the B flat, and then goes, oh wait, no, don't do that.
Right.
You know, and has to undo that and create the negation for that. And so a lot of this, like, striving for technical perfection, which is how it's framed for us, right? Like, this has to be perfect, is not, you know, perfection in that sense is not a complete lack of error, but it's a complete presence of every type of beautiful sound that you want to make.
So as an example, if I may, would you be suggesting an instruction instead of don't crack the first B flat, right? You know, sing through the first B flat, or, you know,
yeah, or
release the first B flat with beautiful air, or something that's going to help the technique, but also kind of support the musical decision that you want to make without offering anything negative.
Right. So instead of, you know, don't crack the first note to write a spring, or as I hear with a lot of students, you know, every time I teach a masterclass, what were you saying to yourself right before you started playing? And 9 times out of 10, it's something along the lines of, like, don't mess it up, which is not only negative, but also not specific. So at that point, you're just mean. So you're not only rude, but also not useful. But instead of don't mess it up, you know, don't crack the first B flat of the Mozart becomes, you know, vent the first B flat, fill, you know, 100% breath. Talk about breath in terms of percentage. 100% breath, voice, high voicing, vent. And I have a very specific technical setup. I tend to think and approach my instrument from a very technical standpoint, so that works really well for me. But I've had students before and, you know, friends that things like colors work really well, or characters. So projecting something that's I don't mean positive as in feel good, but positive as in does not contain a negative word, like, right, doesn't contain any form of the word no.
What to do, not what not to do.
What exactly, you know, and that even reframing, if we want to zoom out and get a little meta about it, it is creating a positive command, not undoing your negative commands.
Oh, that's, yeah, such valuable advice, and it seems like such a simple thing, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there thinking, oh, I think I don't do that. I think I do it the wrong way, kind of, or, you know, and once again.
And there is naturally some resistance to it if you feel like, if on some level you think that that's sugarcoating.
Right.
Right, because I'm sure there are some people listening that are thinking that way too, that's, well, I need to be hard on myself because that's how I get better.
Right, there's plenty of research out there for anyone thinking that looking at comparisons between negative reinforcement and constructive, you know, kind, supportive reinforcement, and like how much of a difference that makes, where you can still be like detail oriented and critical without being harsh or negative or demeaning.
Yes, it's still specific, it's still useful, it's still productive. And I feel the same way, this is the same way that I approach, kind of to loop back to this, you know, a meditation practice. I'm not sitting down with the intent of avoiding thoughts. I'm sitting down with the intent of pursuing a stillness.
Right.
Which is fundamentally a very different approach for me, at least, and I think for a lot of people.
Yeah. This is so much good stuff, Kayla. I think we can already think about planning another talk at some point very soon.
I'd love that.
But rather than going too much longer, I want to start to wrap it up a little bit. But are there any specific questions that you would like me to ask that I haven't yet, or any specific topics you'd like to discuss today?
Oh, gosh. I'd love to speak again sometime because there is so much that we could dig into. I know that I have mentioned to you before that a lot of my kind of fledgling academic research is based on how some of these concepts relate to students and professionals of all levels, recognizing signs of burnout and mitigating for that before we get to a point where we have students changing majors or, you know, really wonderful professionals and musicians and artists who, you know, to quit playing their instruments. So there are some things that I'd love to another time kind of get into some of those big things, but I think it's worth recognizing at least in a blurb, in the elevator pitch, that's the big picture of some of these practices from a musical standpoint. And just from a humanistic standpoint, you know, we can avoid, not even avoid. No, see, there I go. I got to catch myself using the negative command. We're not avoiding. I'm always in my learning process too. We can promote a healthier outlook on anything in life by recognizing these tendencies and, you know, being proactive about them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I will look forward to a deeper dive into the question of burnout, because I think that's a pressing concern for a lot of, well, people, but also especially a lot of musicians. So.
And a lot of people around a global pandemic.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Even more so in the last couple of years. How can listeners, if they're interested, find more about you, social media, websites, projects, anything specific you'd like to share?
Yeah, almost everything is linked on my website, which is just my first name, lastname.com, Kayla Bellamy, that's with a C, C-A-Y-L-A, Bellamy.com. And I'm most active in social media on Instagram, just C.A. Bellamy. And I'm also on Facebook, both for me and for the bassoon studio here at Colorado State, where I'm teaching. We're at CSU Bassoon.
Great. That's so wonderful. Thank you again, Kayla, for all your time today, and really appreciate this wonderful conversation and look forward to our next one.
Yeah, thank you so much.
A big thank you again to Dr. Kayla Bellamy for a wonderful conversation. As always, I will provide links to all of the websites and social media references that Kayla mentioned. And please like and subscribe our podcast so you stay up to date on all new episodes. And if you would like more information about me or Mindful Musical Life, you can find that on our website, mindfulmusicallife.com.